I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Each Monday, we talk with Dr. Scott Hardiman, and he is a physician at Gateway ENT, an urgent specialist. And we just talked to him basically about the medical side, the nonpartisan side of COVID, and how basically we can get our facts straight because there's a lot of noise out there. Doctor, thanks for coming back. It's good to have you here.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
So the number one question that I have for you is I saw a tweet earlier today, and you know Twitter is where you go to get all of your facts. So I saw a tweet today that said that flu cases were down 98%. I don't know if 98% is the factual information, but are we seeing a drastic dip in flu cases this year? And if so, is there an obvious explanation for that?
I don't know that we could really say that for sure yet. I didn't see that tweet, but we're really just beginning to enter into the influenza season. So most people are out getting flu shots now, and we're starting to see a few cases of flu A and B pop up here and there, but largely we haven't really hit the majority of that time period yet. And it hits at different times from year to year, so it's going to be difficult to know for another month or 6 weeks probably until we really get in flu season.
Is the way that we track these cases between like COVID and flu, if you have COVID, can you have flu at the same time? And if you have COVID and you have flu, would you get marked as both?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're really in uncharted territory on this because this pandemic has really shed a light on testing every single thing that walks through the door. You know, there's a lot of estimations that take place every year, not just with influenza cases, because most of those are not being reported to the states, and those tests are being done at any primary care doctor's office or at urgent cares or ERs all over the place. And so the volume of testing that gets done doesn't really report to the level that we're expected to report COVID-19 and coronavirus cases now. So in theory, yes, you could have both of those. I think that's the biggest reason why the flu vaccine is being pushed this year, is to try and eliminate sort of one more thing that complicates the diagnostic chain as far as figuring out what respiratory illnesses you have. So even though there's plenty of coronavirus to go around out there, there's the vast majority of people who get sick with things are not coronavirus still. And so it's if you can eliminate some of those things out, whether that's RSV, whether it's influenza, strep throat, mono, anything from the respiratory plethora of illnesses that you get, it tends to just make the confusion a lot less. And people do come in with symptoms of COVID-19.
Dr. Hardiman, I wanted to jump in with a flu question myself, actually. Mm-hmm. With the flu, I keep hearing people say that, well, flu's not something that we beat. You know, this is something that we have seasons of flu, and then it's not as if we get to April and, all right, we beat the flu. Is that going to be the case with COVID, that it's just something we kind of have to learn to live with?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is yes. There's a lot of folks who use this rhetoric of saying we can crush this thing out of existence and we can make this go away. I'm just not convinced, and I think most logical thinking individuals would agree that that's not going to be the case. You know, this is something that, coronavirus is, there's many different strains of it. This particular one is what we're dealing with currently, and it's probably going to be around for a long time. I think there's a good chance that we're going to get a vaccine at some point that'll help to slow the spread and transmission, but it would not surprise me from the practice of medicine if years to come, this is just one more thing in the mix that sort of passes through the season of respiratory illnesses that we've got to kind of manage and know how to recognize the signs and symptoms of that. And hopefully, just like with Tamiflu and other medications that you can use to treat some of these other respiratory illnesses early on, hopefully we'll get to a point with therapeutics that it becomes less of a concern for the older population or those with other health issues, which, again, largely is the situation of folks who tend to die of this. you know, influenza is really arguably more detrimental to the younger population than COVID-19 is, but clearly in coronavirus or COVID-19, the older population tends to be hit a lot harder with this.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, a physician at Gateway ENT, also urgent specialists. You've mentioned two things here that I think we need to talk about, therapeutics and the vaccine. And you said you think we're going to get a vaccine soon. Certainly, if you listen to the politicians, you know, President Trump has said as of even yesterday that that vaccine should be here by the end of the year. He said it again at the debate the other night. What is the process of getting a vaccine approved? Because we know that this one has been fast-tracked. What's the process of this particular vaccine, and how likely do you think it is that we will see an approved vaccine by the end of the year?
It's hard to say with 100% certainty because we have to wait on all that phase 3 data to come back in. You know, statistically, you can show a trend one way or the other with some early data. But most, it doesn't seem now that phase 3 trials have opened up, I believe it was around August 1st or so, there's a number of people, 25,000-30,000 people that need to be enrolled in the different phase 3 studies. And they're being fairly tight-lipped about those results at this point because it's going to take some time, I think, to really determine the safety and efficacious nature of the vaccine itself. There's 5, maybe 6 now that are in phase 3 trials, and it's a slow process. I think getting through those initial... Three, usually, yeah. And usually once they get to phase 3 trials, you're assuming that a lot of the safety measures have been done. They've done some preliminary animal studies. But some of these vaccines are a similar concept that other vaccines exist out there. And so some of that initial data was able to run through fairly quickly, hence the rapid speed that they were able to do that. But time will tell, I think, with the long-term side effects of vaccines or the benefit of the vaccines as well. But it's coming. I mean, I think we've been – there's a lot of – with that much weight behind the science, I'm pretty confident that they're going to get a vaccine at some point. It just depends on how quickly it rolls out. By the end of the year, it's possible. But I would doubt that it's broadly available that early. It's going to be probably into quarter one or two of next year before it would be pretty readily available.
And then in addition to the vaccine, we were talking about therapeutics, which is what the president has said that he's as excited, if not more excited, about the thought of really developing good therapeutics to treat patients who are, you know, suffering from COVID. What are some of the therapeutics that are out there and which ones are you excited about?
Well, there's I would probably bunch all those together in that there's multiple tiers of things that you do. We've learned a tremendous amount over the last 6, 7, 8 months on how to manage patients, when to intervene from a ventilation standpoint, when to give steroids, to giving those into more significantly severe patients versus early on where it can complicate things a bit. Most of the treatment still is largely supportive. Fortunately, most people don't have bad outcomes of this. Once in the hospital, the only treatment that is largely used is remdesivir. The initial studies on that obviously showed some marginal benefit. There's a great big study out called the Solidarity Study that really didn't show an improvement in mortality with that, but it's in pre-publication at this point, so it's not been peer-reviewed to determine how accurate that study is. And, of course, you want all these things to work, right? When we talk about this, we should certainly when you say something doesn't seem to work, you hope it does, obviously, but like they've held many other outpatient therapeutics such as hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or other drugs that are out there, they've held those to a standard of controlled studies on them. I think we have to do the same thing of these drugs that get utilized in hospital. And then, of course, convalescent plasma is still used in clinical trials, as is the monoclonal antibody therapy, which the president received. He had probably a cocktail of all of these things, which you, of course, give to anyone in that position.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, a physician at Gateway ENT, an urgent specialist. Dr. Hardiman, all of the treatments that you were just listing and explaining, are we seeing those actually make an impact on either hospitalization rates or especially death rates yet?
Yeah, the mortality is definitely different today than it was back in in the early phases of this. We had anywhere from 300 or 400 deaths a day to just slightly over 1,000, depending on the day. And sometimes it's older data that's accumulated all at once. But I think overall, the daily death toll is still at a relatively low place compared to the way it was back in March, April, and May. And so the therapeutics, I think, as a whole and how we manage patients are getting better outcomes in general. There's other countries that have adopted totally different treatment parameters and protocols. We have a lot of drugs that we've sort of pushed by the wayside and said that they're ineffective. They are being used exclusively in other countries. And it's a tricky thing to try and determine, because when the vast majority of people do improve spontaneously with this and don't end up in the intensive care unit or even hospitalized or ventilated, it's difficult to know when you intervene early on, is that just the natural course of the illness, or is that some impact of these therapeutics that are being used? But it makes it tricky to try to determine that.
We've got Dr. Scott Hardiman on with us right now. He is a physician at Gateway ENT, also at Urgent Specialists. What, do you have any thoughts on the idea that we're rounding a corner? Because I kind of feel like anytime someone says that, there's a way you can say that's true and there's a way you can say that's not true. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, it's hard to really make a statement one way or the other when you're still seeing daily numbers of cases go up, et cetera, et cetera. But I think you have to take a step back. And we've always talked about that this is something that's going to move through society. It seems to be, doing so, and we're seeing numbers of cases go up. The death rate doesn't seem to be following that up, which is fantastic. That indicates that it may not be as lethal as what was initially thought. And clearly it isn't as lethal as what was initially thought when we start to see some initial data coming out of Northern Italy and China. Mark Meadows made that statement yesterday in the context of, can we make this go away? And the answer is, like we said earlier, really no. I mean, there's really almost no way in an open society like we have to suppress something out of existence like that any more than you can, strep throat or influenza or anything else that's there. So we have to learn to mitigate it as best we can, slow down transmission, identify which mitigation strategies make the most sense, not do blanket lockdowns, which just crush society and create a whole bunch of other issues related to healthcare and economics and everything else, and figure out a path forward at this point. So I think to some degree, you could say we're rounding the corner because we are learning to manage this better every single day. The flip side of that is that there's a lot of cases out there right now. And as we move through society and we roll into winter months, it's going to be really an interesting time to try and sort through all of that.
Question from Todd on our Facebook page for you, Doctor. He says, will getting a flu shot in any way help from prevent getting China virus?
No, totally different viruses. The influenza vaccines are usually made off of a prediction of the strain of influenza that's probably 12 months earlier out of East Asia and then works its way here. So they're just completely unrelated. But the last thing you want to do is have your body be debilitated from getting influenza and then become exposed to coronavirus as well, because the outcomes there are probably going to be poor, and obviously some sort of simultaneous infection would be likely pretty devastating if that were to happen. So the flu shot, if you can do anything to try and minimize your risk of getting other respiratory illnesses this winter, it's a smart thing to do.
Well, let me ask you a question here just from a follow-up to that one. What are some, we've talked about this before, but it's always a good reminder, what are some things that people can do to try to boost their immune system? And, you're not going to be able to keep yourself from getting it necessarily, but what are things you can do to maybe strengthen your ability to fight it if you do get it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's quite a few things that you should really think of. So vitamin D and vitamin C are known immune boosters. There's quite a bit of evidence out there now that vitamin D deficiency, which we're heading into our darker months of the year, obviously, can make you more at risk or have poor outcomes, I should say, not so much more at risk of getting this, but poor outcomes. Zinc is a good antiviral supplement. It's been known for decades that it has antiviral properties. There's a lot of talk about these cocktails of taking elderberry as well as zinc and then vitamin D and vitamin C. Elderberry has an active ingredient called quercetin, which is thought to help get zinc inside the cells and help to be an antiviral medication in that regard, too.
Question from Christopher on our Facebook page for you, Doctor. In the event that we do somehow crush this out of existence, does that leave a blueprint to end the common cold or anything else?
Not likely, because those viruses have a tendency to mutate and change enough that while you do get some carryover immunity to that, meaning that there are multiple strains of rhinovirus or coronavirus that lead to the common cold, being exposed to some and having an immune response to that helps to protect you against some of those other strains, which is why some colds and respiratory infections tend to be more severe versus others, depending on the immune response. So it's not really a blueprint to make those things go away. There's really no situation where we're never in this world going to not be exposed to communicable illnesses like that. But fortunately, we do have a really smart immune system. And even with COVID-19, we see that, that the vast majority of people are able to fight this off without any long-term sequelae of it and tend to do pretty well. The big question will be is if that tends to protect them against future mutations in this particular illness and if there is a potential risk of secondary infection or getting it again.
Let me ask you Don's question. He's watching on our YouTube channel. He said, with flu and cold season, how is one to tell the difference between the three? Do you need to test or treat for the symptoms of a flu and cold? So your advice to people, if you get the sniffles, I mean, I guess there's going to be an initial onset of panic. When do you go get your COVID test?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer with 100% certainty because there are some subtle differences in the illness. For coronavirus, you know, you hear things of headache, loss of sense of taste and smell, fever, of course, lower respiratory symptoms, a cough and shortness of breath are pretty good giveaways for that. But those symptoms also mimic a lot of symptoms of the common cold or of influenza. It's pretty tricky if every time someone gets a sniffle and just ask the teachers in the schools that are in right now what to do with those if you want to send every one of those kids off for a COVID test. And the answer is you really don't need to. Give it a 24, 48 hours. The issue is really more social in that regard, that if you think you have it and you're sick with something, what do you do with yourself in that time? Because it's not like you're going to run off and get a prescription for something that's going to suddenly make it go away. My advice for people is, you know, if there's a common cold and we're in flu season going around, give it a couple of days, see how the symptoms are doing, communicate with your doctor or healthcare provider, get a sense of what the symptoms are. There are a couple telltale ones like the loss of sense of taste and smell, excessive fatigue, headaches, of course, lower respiratory symptoms that may raise your index of concern for coronavirus. But a lot of things that tend to be more just garden variety respiratory illnesses, after 24 to 48 hours, you get a sense of which direction you're heading with that and you're improved. So it's definitely not a foregone conclusion that every time you get a sniffle or a symptom of a cold, you should run off and get a COVID test.
I would think that is the loss of sense of taste and smell one of the key indicators. You're not going to get that with flu and cold as much.
Well, the reality is you do. So, you know, in my world as an ENT physician, you can have those things, but they tend to be less frequent. Most people who have a bad head cold and their nose is stuffy, of course, they'll say, I feel like my sense of smell and taste is off a bit. But those are usually pretty short-lived and tend to be within 24 to 48 hours as your congestion starts to improve, those symptoms and sensations tend to come back. The coronavirus really, I mean, it really seems to knock out the olfactory nerves to the point that people really lose their sense of taste and smell for a fairly prolonged period of time. But it can happen with any respiratory illness. It's just more common with coronavirus.
Kevin on our YouTube channel says, why is there still not enough PPE to go around? It's been months. I don't know. What is the status on PPE? Or do we have enough for the people who need it right now?
I think the answer is yes. That was a big issue with flattening the curve early on and slowing the transmission enough so that we could not overwhelm the healthcare system with that. There's still some issues with obtaining N95 masks that are of quality and some things within the hospital, but I think largely, at least in the major metropolitan areas, that's pretty readily available. You know, I'm not 100% certain where the first responders and paramedics and firefighters and police officers would say that is for them as well, but I would say for the most part, PPE is pretty readily available for those that need that most in that healthcare front-end line. Obviously, those N95 masks and other things, they're probably best utilized in that environment versus the average person walking around the street.
Speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist. Doctor, we had a question on our YouTube page that was referencing herd immunity. That's not something we've heard as much in the last few weeks. Where does the popular medical opinion stand on where we're at with herd immunity?
Well, like most things with this, there's one set of opinions on one end of the spectrum and another completely on the opposite end of the spectrum. You know, herd immunity is that mythical number you get to, that place you get to where the transmission chains are broken down. Typically, scientifically, we'd say it's 60 to 70% of a population has some sort of immunity so that it breaks transmission of that. There's studies from other countries. I tend to have referenced the one in Sweden where they show that that the herd immunity perhaps was reached at a lower number. Every illness is probably a little bit different in reality. I think it's where most people would agree is allowing sort of just unrestricted expansion of the virus into the community and just hoping that one day you hit that is probably not the best approach to dealing with this. But if you take the natural progression of the illness and who it infects, unfortunately, they all recover. and couple that with vaccines and therapeutics, you know, you're going to slow that down to the point that you can get to that point of herd immunity to this. But for clarification, that doesn't mean this just all goes away. That just means that the transmission rate is at one or below, which means that each person that gets this is, it doesn't have as much of a risk of transmitting to someone else. So it slows down that transmission. But to some degree, it's not like you couldn't potentially get this at some point in the future, even if we did reach herd immunity. You just hope that you slow it down enough that isolated pockets here or there can be quickly stomped out by identifying those individuals and contact tracing people that they'd be in touch with.
Alan on our Facebook page says, do we know how long the antibodies protect those who have recovered? That's a big question a lot of people have.
It's a great question. I think we know it more every single day. I've seen personally antibodies as far as 5 months out in individuals that are still quite elevated, and that gives you a pretty good sense that at least for the near short term and stretching into intermediate term that you're going to be protected from this, or at least have less risk of having some sort of secondary issue. There's, you know, the one or two cases out of the 7 or 8 million that you hear about that people have had a second infection of that. Those really are the outliers. I mean, we're talking about less than 5 documented cases, certainly in this country, if not globally, of second infections with this. And so I think the assumption is still that if you've had this and you have developed an immune response to it, while you shouldn't take things for granted, you should feel pretty confident that you're going to be okay for the future.
We have a follow-up question here from Alan on our Facebook page. He says, is the normal daily vitamin good enough to kind of gird yourself up for this flu and COVID season?
I think it stems to some degree from your overall health status, the answer to that. So most people who have a pretty well-balanced diet, who exercise a bit and who take a daily vitamin, most daily vitamins are going to have some vitamin D, some vitamin C, and zinc all within that. Our food supply is not great. Our micronutrients are depleted from a lot of the store-bought stuff. And so I would say extra supplementation with zinc, with vitamin D and vitamin C are not a bad thing to do. But a multivitamin certainly is way better than nothing. And those vitamins are harder and harder to get because I think people are starting to stock up and prepare for, you know, they're boosting their immune system and just taking better care of their health during the winter months.
I think tracking this virus is what frustrates the people the most, because so many people use different numbers. Certainly in the political realm, it seems as though people use the numbers that politically subsidize the thought process or the direction they would like to head. And in the meantime, we're all fighting this pandemic, and we really want to know, you know, the truth. How dangerous is this virus? We knew how frightened we were at the beginning. Well, we are months into this, 6-7 months into this process here in the United States of America. Where are we now compared to then regarding the survival rate and also the mortality rate? I mean, I saw one article, I can't remember who it was by, but it was talking about, you know, our ability to treat this virus has the survival rate in a much better place now just because we've learned over the course of time. What's your thoughts on that survival rate, mortality rate, and what we've learned over these months?
Yeah, that's 100% true. I think the fear initially we were seeing mortality rates in that 10%, 12%, 15%, which is a terrifying number when you think about that, when they also couple that with, I think it's called the Imperial Palace modeling, that they said that 80% of your society is going to get this. Well, that's a big number of deaths in the country if you had a death rate, a mortality rate of 10 to 15% or so. That fairly quickly proved to not really be the case. Those models were off. Obviously, the mortality rate is way, way, way less than that. With the increase in cases, if the mortalities, number of raw mortalities don't increase at the same rate, eventually the mortality rate's going to continue to decline. There's obviously speculation out there that eventually this will end up in that sort of area around influenza. But it's definitely better, and I think people, that's the take-home point, I think, from all of this, is that, you know, we should have a healthy respect of this, and no one wants to get it, but at the same time, you have well over a 95% chance that if you get it, you're going to survive it and do just fine. And actually about 75 to 80% of people have minimal to no symptoms whatsoever. So it's odds are obviously in your favor to a large degree that you're going to do well with this, but we need to protect those that are most vulnerable and do smart things as the non-most vulnerable people out there, meaning the folks that are out and about in society a little bit. We need to, you know, make smart decisions to not go out when we're ill, to try and do excellent hygiene and mask wearing when necessary and appropriate, and try and slow the transmission so we do protect those people that potentially would have worse outcomes with it.
Dr. Scott Hardiman, it's always a pleasure to have you on with us here, and we are looking forward to talking to you soon about a healthcare plan that you are helping put together for the administration. We cannot wait to talk to you about that. We're going to give that a whole own segment in its entirety, and we'll be doing that very soon.
All right, sounds great. You guys have a good Monday.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.